The Russian President Vladimir Putin calls for closer cooperation between his country and North Korea. Palestinians in the occupied West Bank carry out a new rocket attack on Israeli settlements in response to the regime atrocities. Plus, the former U.S. President Donald Trump is indicted for the fourth time since March, this time over efforts to interfere in the 2020 election. This is news. Thanks for joining us. The Russian president has called for closer cooperation with North Korea. Vladimir Putin issued the call in a message to congratulate North Korean leader Kim Jong-un on the country's National Liberation Day. In the message, Putin said such cooperation will help boost stability and security on the Korean Peninsula and in the Northeast Asian region. Last month, Russia's defense minister also traveled to Pyongyang in the first such visit since the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991. He conveyed Putin's message to the North Korean leader. The message reportedly praised the solidarity of the countries for a multipolar world and the policy toward the collective West in a swipe at the Korean Peninsula tensions and Moscow's tensions with Western governments over the war in Ukraine. Independent researcher and author Greg Simmons was with us and shared his thoughts on how Russia's growing ties with North Korea poses a challenge to the U.S.
What you have had is the U.S.-led unipolar Western-centric order getting its way every time and has been trying to contain and control those countries which do not submit to its whims. I mean, Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea is another one. And so this is a geostrategy, which is a logical one, because the US is overstretched. And now it's got another problem. I mean, I'm surprised that it took this long for Russia to start to cultivate these closer ties with North Korea and other such countries.
At least 33 people have been killed in an explosion ensuing fire at a petrol station in the capital of Russia's Republic of Dagestan. Dozens more have also been injured in the incident. The exact cause of the blast remains unknown. The government of Dagestan has visited the site of the explosion with around 260 emergency workers deployed. The deadly incident has also sparked condolences from President Vladimir Putin. The Republic of Dagestan is one of 83 constituent parts of the Russian Federation and is the southernmost part of the country. Time now for the news review of this bulletin. A Palestinian resistance group has launched yet another rocket attack on an Israeli settlement in response to growing Israeli violence in the occupied territories. The Ayash resistance group says it has targeted an Israeli settlement west of the occupied West Bank city of Jenin with Qassam rocket. In recent months, Palestinian resistance groups have stepped up such attacks in retaliation for the regime's atrocities. The attack came after Israeli forces killed two more young Palestinians early on Tuesday. Israeli forces shot dead the Palestinians during a raid on a refugee camp near the city of Ariha or Jericho. They stormed the camp with dozens of armored vehicles and heavy gunfire. Israeli forces carry out attacks against Palestinians in the occupied territories almost on a daily basis. The regime has killed more than 200 Palestinians since the start of the year. Moti Abu Musab, a Palestinian political activist, joins us from Gaza City. We also have Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, who joins us from London. Welcome to you both. Moti Abu Musab, I'll start first with you. The Gaza Strip obviously has its resistance groups that retaliate when Israel wages wars on them, and also when Palestinians are being targeted. You have them shooting rockets over at Israel. But now you're looking at the West Bank, where you have these resistance coming from the refugee camps, for example. How dangerous is that for Israel?
Yes, first of all, thanks for having me. I think this is an important issue that we need to shed more light on it. From my point of view, I do believe that this presents another concrete evidence that the Israeli occupation forces face a situation of fiasco regarding handling and containing the escalating Palestinian resistance, especially in the West Bank. And despite all this kind of the Israeli brutality continued and practiced against the Palestinian people, today the Palestinian resistance became more eager and more resilient to face the ongoing and the escalating Israeli crimes, taking into consideration that the Israeli occupation forces claimed their aims when they attacked Jenin camp, that they were going to eradicate and to finish the Palestinian resistance groups in the West Bank and Jenin camp. But today, the Palestinian resistance proves once again that it's more resilient and it's eager to develop its abilities and to confront the Israeli escalating crimes perpetrated against the Palestinian people. This is on one hand. On the other hand, it conveys a clear message that nothing would prevent the Palestinian people and the Palestinian resistance from developing its abilities and its capabilities in order to deter the Israeli occupation and to confront the Israeli occupation. It's worth mentioning that since the beginning of this year, the Israeli occupation forces have been murdered and killed more than 227 Palestinians. Out of them, 183 Palestinians from the West Bank. This clearly indicates that the Palestinian resistance rises and grows in front of the rise and increase of the Israeli crimes against the Palestinian people. And I think that the Israeli occupation nowadays actually got the message, the clear message, that that Israel has nothing to do with the escalating Palestinian resistance. And as you know, because the Palestinian people have nothing to do, have no choice but to keep resisting the Israeli occupation. And we have no choice but to face these ongoing Israeli crimes and atrocities committed against the Palestinian people with all means and tools available.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Mohsen Abbas, when you take a look at what's happening here, I'm sure that as we're seeing this unfold, that these the resistance that's coming out of these, for example, refugee camps, one that's been cited, seems like quite often, is the one in Tulkarm, actually, where these armed Palestinian resistance groups are retaliating. But one way or another, they're going to get their hands on not only arms, but maybe more sophisticated weapons and rockets, perhaps. And I think this is Israel's worst nightmare that's unfolding, because you have that now, and you also have from the Gaza Strip, and you also have resistance from, around you, like from coming from Lebanon. Is Israel even capable of handling multi-pronged offensive were it to happen?
I think it's increasingly showing that it's inept at handling even the internal, if you like, resistance, let alone external resistance when it actually joins the struggle, which is an inevitability if Israel doesn't give justice and fairness to the Palestinian people and it relinquish its kind of its illegal occupation. So there are a couple of factors that you've touched on which are really important to emphasize. First, that the Palestinian resistance has the capability of making unguided artillery rockets. They have small arms in abundance. They're able to make rocket-propelled grenades internally within the Palestinian territories, and they're also able to make anti-tank missiles. This is known. They, of course, have the Nasser 3 and 4 missile system and plenty of others. You mentioned the possibility of, perhaps in the future, drone capability. There could be the possibility of more technologically precise precision missile, including the kind that are ballistic. Now, all of those things are very much on the horizon. Israel knows it. They're desperately now clinging to a disintegrating situation internally with the split amongst Israelis, knowing that they no longer have that level of ascendancy. The split you see in terms of the extremist violent settlers and those settler colonialists who continue to land grab and who are now also an integral part of the Zionist government. Netanyahu plays to the tune of those violent settler colonialists who are actually taking over even what little land they've left for the Palestinians. And of course, what they're getting in response is really important. This is the second major point. In response to all this, What you've got is the rise of the likes of Kataib Jenin, which is a new model. It's not based necessarily on the old ideological and hierarchical kind of lines that existed. These are smaller franchises almost, which are models of independent operation within their own particular areas. And that's what you're seeing in Jenin. It's also there in the Balata refugee camp in Nablus, from what I've researched, and that's the second largest city of the West Bank. And the fact that this resistance is now pouring into the West Bank and strong local groups are being able to take hold of things means, first of all, Israel can't go to the PA, a collaborator organization like the Palestinian Authority, to say, go in and control Jenin or control the West Bank. They can't. They can't do it anymore. And they'll be even less empowered to do it as time goes on, as these resistance fighters recognize their strength, because they're recognizing it day by day. This attack by the Israeli forces into Jenin camp less than a month ago is if you compare it to, for instance, the Operation Offensive Shield, which they did back in 2002, which did Jenin as well, you can see how cocky and confident the Israelis were going in and trying to control West Bank at that time. Now they are. They had to leave within 2 days. They didn't achieve their objectives, and they really got an absolute answer from the resistance to say they're not going to be cowed no matter what. The resistance also, as you know, has underground tunnels which they're capable of escaping into. And so Israel knows very well that even if they try to go in to occupy the likes of Gaza or Jenin, actually they're going to get a lot of casualties, and there is going to be significant resistance. And the weapons that will come in the near future will meet the odds even more weighed against the Israelis having a free-for-all in occupied Palestine.
Thank you for that, Samson Abbas, journalist and political commentator. And thank you, Moti Abu Musabab, Palestinian political activist. With that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. The UN has denounced a deadly terrorist attack on a shrine in Iran as abhorrent.
The Secretary General strongly condemns the terrorist attack that we saw on the holy site in Shiraz on 13 August yesterday, which is, as you know, the second attack in the last 10 months. Acts targeting religious sites, places of worship, are abhorrent. The Secretary General stresses the need to bring justice to the perpetrators of this crime against civilians exercising their right to practice their religion freely. The Secretary General conveys his deepest condolences to the bereaved families and the people of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and he wishes a speedy recovery to those injured.
The European Union also condemned the shooting at the Shah Cheragh Shrine in the southern city of Shiraz. The EU spokesman, Peter Stano, says the attack is yet another example of terrorists targeting innocent civilians. Several countries, including Russia, Syria, Qatar, and the UAE, have also slammed the tragic incident that happened on Sunday night. The terrorist attack has so far left 2 people dead and several others injured. One assailant was arrested at the holy site. The shrine was the scene of another terror attack last October, which claimed more than a dozen lives. Our correspondent Mahdi Abbasian is now in the city of Shiraz. He has been present inside of the terror attack there, and he gave us details on how it took place.
This area, the Bab al-Mahdi entrance gate of the Shah Cheragh Holy Shrine. And the area is cordoned off, and we are the first people who have entered this area since Sunday evening when this abhorrent crime, this terrorist attack, took place here in Shiraz. There are some doors behind me. There are two doors. These are the entrance doors, and a big gate behind me, which is the exit gate. The thing about this terror attack is that the attacker entered the Holy Shrine from the exit gate, so the security forces could not search him for having weapons. Then he enters this area and starts shooting people sporadically. There are some bullet holes. Several people were injured in this attack, and unfortunately, one of them was killed instantly here. and another one was seriously injured who succumbed to his wounds last night in the Namazi hospital of the city of Shiraz.
Moving on, former U.S. President Donald Trump is facing another indictment on charges related to the 2020 presidential election. A grand jury in Georgia has indicted Trump and 18 of his allies for their efforts to overturn the election results in the state.
Today, based on information developed by that investigation, a Fulton County grand jury returned a true bill of indictment, charging 19 individuals with violations of Georgia law arising from a criminal conspiracy to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election in this state. The indictment includes 41 felony counts and is 97 pages long. Please remember that everyone charged in this bill of indictment is presumed innocent. Specifically, the indictment brings felony charges against Donald John Trump.
Willis said the indictment alleges that the defendants engaged in a criminal racketeering enterprise to overturn Georgia's election results. She added that the grand jury has issued arrest warrants for those individuals. Willis urged the defendants to voluntarily surrender later than noon on Friday, August 25th. Trump has denounced what he called a rigged indictment. This is the second time this month that the former president is indicted on charges related to the election interference case. In early August, he pleaded not guilty to federal charges during a court hearing in Washington, D.C. Trump is also facing other legal woes, including sexual abuses and his alleged mishandling of classified files. Our correspondent in Chicago, Ramin Mazari, told us more about the latest indictment issued against Donald Trump.
You see polls even now saying that 70% of Republicans believe that the 2020 election was stolen. So, you know, just from an objective point of view, there's still so much controversy over here about 2020. Looking forward to 2024, it's, you know, some people are saying that, you know, Democrats are saying that this is something which is, you know, which is necessary to uphold the law. And Republicans are saying that they have intentionally slow walked these investigations to discredit Trump ahead of the 2024 vote. People just really view what's going on in the Beltway in Washington as something that is corrupt and is, you know, beyond their ability to remedy. And all of these trials, many people will say, and many people here say it in the United States, is that it makes America look like a banana republic. And there are these, you know, four cases in 5 months of the leading presidential candidates.
With that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. Thanks for being with us. Bye-bye for now.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
واقعیت زندگی
and try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن.
By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من، این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم نیست.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
ولا تتفرقوا فيه.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن، دوری از قرآن، از قرآن.
Muslims major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
کتاب الله. بسم الله.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on June 11, 2023, in a meeting with a number of scientists, specialists, experts, and officials of Iran's nuclear industry. Most of you didn't see or experience the period before the revolution. We lived for many years during that period and are familiar with the issues of that time. You too can come to know about it today. If you study and pay attention, you can understand what took place during those days. I am frank with you. We had both kinds of istizaf, weaknesses, in the period prior to revolution. First, they kept us weak. Nuclear scientists, such as martyrs Rezai Nejad, Shahriari, Fakhrizadeh, were all trained in the era of the Islamic Revolution. There were young men like them before the revolution, but they never reached the same level as these men. They wouldn't let them improve. They used to humiliate the Iranian nation and hinder the people's progress.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Back in those days, in a meeting that I had with one of the officials of the Pahlavi regime, by chance, because I wasn't in contact with them, I mean I sat in a meeting and he happened to be there by chance, I started criticizing some things. I was young then and had the patience to talk, discuss matters, and do similar things. The official's response was, "Man, what are you talking about? We are sitting here while the Europeans and others are working for us like servants. They bring and manufacture different products for us to use." Do you see what kind of logic they had? Their rationale was others make things and we use them, thus they are our servants. The Europeans would take our oil and took over our markets, and they interfered in our policies to the maximum extent. This foolish person who was talking with me considered such a thing to be something that the nation should be proud of. This is what I mean when I say that a nation has been held back. This is one method for weakening a nation. The second method was to instill the belief we cannot in the people and in the youth. During the period when Iran's oil industry was nationalized, at the time of Mohammad Mossadegh, the Iranian National Parliament discussed nationalizing the oil industry so that they could take it out of the clutches of the British.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Anti-French sentiment runs high in Niger as thousands of people have rallied near a French military base on the outskirts of the capital, Niamey, to call for the withdrawal of the country's forces. Protesters shouted "Down with France" and "Down with ECOWAS" as they surrounded the base. The demonstrators argued that the West African Regional Bloc is not independent and is being manipulated by France. ECOWAS has given the green light for a military intervention in Niger after it approved the deployment of a standby force as part of its effort to remove Niger's military rulers following last month's coup and reinstate deposed pro-Western leader Mohamed Bazoum. The Ivory Coast president says heads of state of the 15-nation bloc have agreed that the operation should start as soon as possible. The president said his country will provide a maximum of 1,100 troops alongside soldiers from Nigeria and Benin. He said other member countries will join them later. France has thrown its full backing to all the conclusions of the West African leaders who met in Nigerian capital Abuja to make the necessary arrangements. The United States has also voiced support for efforts of ECOWAS on Niger.
As significantly, ECOWAS, the organization that brings together West African countries, is playing a lead role in making clear the imperative of the return to constitutional order, and we very much support ECOWAS's leadership and work on this.
The support for ECOWAS efforts come as a deadline set by the regional bloc for Bazoum to be reinstated on August 6th was ignored by Nigerian junta. The junta has moved one step further and announced a new government there. The developments in Niger come nearly 3 weeks after soldiers belonging to the country's presidential guard blockaded access to President Bazoum's residence in Niamey and arrested him. Shortly after the storming of the president's residence, the army led by General Abdurrahman Tiani took control of the country's political leadership there.
The idea of a military intervention is being pushed by certain countries like France and the U.S. This is because the two Western countries are seeking their political and economic interests in Niger. pushing ECOWAS to do whatever it can to reinstate the former pro-West leader.
The idea of a military intervention in Niger comes as many people across the West African nation are opposed to foreign meddling in their internal political affairs.
Today they're in front of our army. It's no longer that they're in front of us. That's to say, if they're thinking of attacking the military, they will first have to attack us, the people of Niger.
But unlike Nigerians, Western countries, namely France and the United States, are pushing for a military intervention there. After all, there are certain facts that lie within their interest, which a change in Nigerian political leadership can hamper all those benefits. In the case of France, the country has domination over Niger's economy. That's why Paris has been seeking a military solution to the crisis in Niger since the very first day of the outbreak of the coup there. One significant factor is Niger's vast uranium reserves. The country supplies around 5% of the world's uranium and is a leading supplier of that chemical element to the European Union. The French government is almost entirely dependent on Niger, as some 25% of Niger's uranium production goes to France. Using that uranium to produce electricity, Paris has become a large exporter of power that goes to countries like Germany and other European nations. The electricity export of that amount makes French huge profits, which make it hard for Paris to admit new political changes in Niger. In the case of the United States, Washington is seeing a growing tendency toward Russia among people in West African nations, including Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali, and that is why, seeing its political interests in tatters, it is pushing for a military intervention in Niger to reinstate pro-West former President Bazoum. With ECOWAS being under the direct influence of Western powers, an actual military intervention in Niger is not unthinkable, despite repeated warnings from Russia that any such move would destabilize the whole region. But apart from that, what matters most of all is that Niger belongs to Nigerians, and they are the ones who should decide their own fate. Given all the anti-Western hatred among the people of Niger and other West African nations, it seems that it is for the Western countries to stop meddling in the affairs of those nations and let people choose their own political path.
The Iranian Foreign Ministry has announced the start of a process to unfreeze Iran's assets blocked in South Korea due to American sanctions.
The process for releasing several billion dollars of the Islamic Republic of Iran's assets, which had been illegally frozen in South Korea by the United States for several years, has started. Iran has received necessary guarantees that the U.S. will abide by its commitments in this regard.
The ministry said the decision on how to utilize these unfrozen resources lies with the Islamic Republic of Iran, adding that the assets will be used to meet the country's needs. That followed claims that Iran's access to these assets will be limited. Meanwhile, under the deal, a number of Iranians whom the foreign ministry statement said are held in the U.S. under the false accusations of circumventing sanctions will be released. The ministry said several American prisoners in Iran, whose freedom was sought by Washington, are still in Tehran. Iran's mission at the United Nations put the number of those prisoners at 5, that they have been released to house arrest in preparation for a prisoner swap between the two countries. And Iran's Vice President for Political Affairs, Mohammad Jamshidi, said the American prisoners will leave the country after Iranian assets are fully transferred to Tehran. It came after reports by U.S. media outlets, including the New York Times and the CNN, quoted sources as saying that Washington will allow the transfer of nearly $6 billion of Iran's assets in South Korea to an account in the Central Bank of Qatar. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has welcomed the prisoner swap, but said the U.S. will keep up sanctions against Iran.
In any event, in any respect, Iran will not be receiving any sanctions relief. And in any instance where we would engage in such efforts to bring Americans home from Iran, Iran's own funds would be used and transferred to restricted accounts such that the monies can only be used for humanitarian purposes, which, as you know, is permitted under our sanctions. There's an exemption for humanitarian that's there from the start.
The Islamic Republic has in the past rejected U.S. claims of sanctions exemptions for humanitarian purposes. Iran says the sanctions are inhumane and illegal and has directly affected its people's life. Former U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew his country from the 2015 Iran deal in 2018, restoring sanctions on the Islamic Republic. That was part of what Trump called a maximum pressure campaign, which has continued under his successor Joe Biden. Part of the campaign has resulted in business restrictions. But Iranian officials say the so-called pressure campaign has failed as Iran's oil exports has come closer to the figures prior to the reimposition of the sanctions. Statistical data also shows Iran's non-oil exports to the neighboring and friendly states have grown drastically in the past few years. Tehran has time and again blasted the U.S. for what it sees as addiction to sanctions. Based on a report in May 2022, Iran has between $100 and $120 billion trapped in foreign accounts because of the U.S. sanctions. The latest agreement between Tehran and Washington to release several billions of Iran's frozen assets is hailed as another example of an active and dignified diplomacy. Policies that the administration of Iran's president, Ebrahim Raisi, says are on its agenda to protect the rights of the Iranian people in any situation. And the latest deal is significant because it has preserved Iran's dignity as Tehran would not take the first step unless the U.S. shows its commitments under the deal. Also, it is the Islamic Republic that decides for which purposes it uses the unblocked funds, with the foreign ministry saying they would be used to meet the country's needs. The release of Iranian funds in South Korea comes after several billions of dollars of other Iranian assets frozen in Iraq were unblocked in July this year. Iran has time and again said it will continue to safeguard its rights and will never bow to outside pressure.
The U.S. publication has obtained a classified document suggesting Washington pushed for the removal of former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan from office. The document has been published by The Intercept. According to the secret cable known internally as a cipher, a meeting took place on March 7, 2022, between the Pakistani ambassador to the U.S., Asad Majid Khan, and two State Department officials. During the meeting, U.S. officials, including the Assistant Secretary of State for the Bureau of South and Central Asian Affairs, Donald Liu, encouraged the Pakistani government to remove Imran Khan over his neutrality over the war in Ukraine. The day before the meeting, Khan addressed a rally and responded directly to European calls that Pakistan rally behind Ukraine. During that rally, Khan said Pakistanis were not slaves to the Europeans and Americans. He said, "We are friends of Russia, and we are also friends of the U.S. We are friends of China and Europe. We are not part of any alliance." 1 month after the meeting with U.S. officials, a no-confidence vote was held in Parliament, leading to Khan's removal from power. The vote is believed to have been organized with the backing of Pakistan's powerful military. The cable reveals both the carrots and the sticks that the State Department deployed in its push against Khan, U.S. officials promising warmer relations if Khan was removed. They also threatened Pakistan with isolation if Khan was not removed from power. The diplomatic meeting came 2 weeks after the war began between Russia and Ukraine. Before his ouster, Khan had already accused the, quote, foreign power of funding a conspiracy to topple his democratically elected government.
So I get this message. Donald Liu is telling the ambassador that unless I, Imran Khan, is removed as the prime minister in the no-confidence motion, there'll be consequences for Pakistan. It was a conspiracy. It was the army chief. It was the guy who's the prime minister right now. And the U.S. came into it as thinking as I'm someone anti-American. Some reason, if you don't agree with the U.S. foreign policy, you're turned anti-American. First, worry about your own people rather than getting involved in conflicts.
The unnamed foreign power was interpreted as a clear reference to the U.S. Following Khan's ouster from power, Pakistan plunged into a crisis. He was elected in July 2018, promising to fight corruption and to fix the economy. But those pledges went unmet, and the world's second largest Muslim country was gripped by a financial crisis after Khan's removal His supporters took to the streets across Pakistan to show their support for the removed prime minister. Since his removal from power, about 200 court cases have been lodged against Khan by the military-backed government.
All my time is spent from going from one court to another courtroom. I have made, in 2 months, over 350 court appearances. And my legal team is busy fending off one case after the other. But the thing is, nothing sticks, because these are frivolous, bogus cases. And what now they are planning to do is to have military courts. And this is right now in the Supreme Court, whether the courts will allow military courts or not. And the objective of the military court is that there I certainly will be sentenced.
The former prime minister has maintained that the cases against him are politically motivated to keep him out of power. He says the country's powerful military is behind these cases. Khan has been barred from holding public office for 5 years by the country's electoral authorities. The decision was announced by the Election Commission of Pakistan days after Khan was sentenced to 3 years in prison for corruption. Under Pakistani laws, a convicted person cannot run for public office for a period set out by the Election Commission of Pakistan.
The recent premature decision by the Election Commission of Pakistan is just another method for this unmandated government to try to eliminate Imran Khan from the political landscape of Pakistan. We must remember that Imran Khan was, is, and always will remain the chairman of Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf, the largest national-level party in the country. Imran Khan's case against him from a session court will be reversed.
Khan is not the first Pakistani prime minister to be convicted of alleged corruption. It is believed the political system in Pakistan is widely mired in corruption, and none of the politicians and political parties have shown any desire to fix the system. On Thursday, Pakistan's parliament was dissolved on the recommendation of Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif, making way for a general election amid political and economic crises. But the vote could be delayed several months, with the Election Commission set to start redrawing hundreds of constituencies based on a fresh consensus. Analysts have said any delay in the election could fuel public anger and add to uncertainty in the cash-strapped country.
Iran has hosted a conference dubbed Iran and BRICS Prospects for Partnership and Cooperation at the Foreign Ministry's Institute for Political and International Studies in the capital, Tehran. Officials from the ministry, as well as a group of foreign ambassadors residing in the Iranian capital, participated in the event, which aims at identifying mutual capacities between the sides. The BRICS group of fast-developing economies, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, is often seen as an alternative to Western economic and political hegemony. It accounts for 42% of the global population and about 26% of the world's economy. Addressing the conference, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian highlighted the significant role of BRICS in driving global economic growth, saying the Islamic Republic can be a reliable and influential partner of the five-member bloc of emerging economies.
The Islamic Republic of Iran is a reliable and effective partner in bilateral and multilateral cooperation due to its unique geostrategic situation and geographical location. It has massive energy sources, especially petroleum and gas, and it has an inexpensive and short transportation channel. The country has young, skilled, and professional workers and new and innovative scientific and technological resources.
The foreign minister hailed the favorable state of Iran's political and economic relations with BRICS members and underlined the need for all sides to further boost economic ties. He also stressed that BRICS represents a powerful economic and political synergy with the potential to influence regional and global developments. The BRICS summit will be held in Johannesburg, South Africa, on August 22nd to 24th. According to South African Foreign Minister Naledi Pandor, among the topics to be discussed at the BRICS summit will be the organization's expansion. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi has received a formal invitation from South Africa to attend the summit. Iran is among dozens of countries that seek membership in the BRICS and has submitted a formal application to join the body. For decades after the Cold War, the world witnessed a U.S. linipolar hegemonic order. In recent years, however, a new multipolar world order has been emerging, with certain countries challenging the U.S.'s economic and political dominance. Also, perceptions of American arrogance and hypocrisy are widespread. Trust in the international systems that the U.S. helped invent and has presided over since World War II is long gone. After two decades of bloody military interventions across the West Asia, namely in Afghanistan and Iraq, the United States has lost much of its moral credibility as well. Russian and Chinese leaders have long expressed a desire for a more multipolar order, as have the leaders of emerging powers such as India or Brazil. So has Iran. And for the Islamic Republic, BRICS can be the next significant target of its multilateralism policy. According to the latest data released by the Islamic Republic of Iran Customs Administration, the value of Iran's non-oil trade with BRICS group of countries hits $38.43 billion in the 2022-2023 fiscal year, showing a 14% hike compared to the same period a year earlier. That's while the West, particularly the U.S., have imposed several rounds of unilateral sanctions against Tehran. Many states have been applying for membership in international bodies in a bid to promote multilateralism and counter unilateral policies. In addition, last month, Iran gained full membership in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the world's largest regional organization in terms of geographic scope and population. In an address to a meeting of the Friends of BRICS foreign ministers in Cape Town in June, Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian said Iran is among the pioneers of multilateralism. He added that the era of unilateralism is coming to an end and that the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and the BRICS group of countries will play major roles in the future as a new world order is emerging.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
As-salamu alayka ya Amin Allah fi ardik.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام إن هذه القلوب تمل كما تمل الأبدان فابتغوا لها طرائف الحكمة.
Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali alayhi salam, said, "The hearts become tired as the bodies become tired. You should therefore search for beautiful sayings for them to enjoy by way of refreshment."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program is To My Brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So, dear friends, of course, the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is a persona which is truly amazing. We continue to talk about these various aspects and these different angles of the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, and we still have so much more that we can talk about. He is truly the living, breathing miracle of the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. One of the things that we really learn and we really see in the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is this fact that he had a very positive outlook on life. We don't find that he had a negative outlook. And matter of fact, this is what Islam teaches us. This is what the Holy Quran teaches us. And of course, this is what the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, the divinely appointed imams, they teach us. The Almighty Allah wants us to always be positive, to have a negative outlook on life, to have a pessimistic outlook on life. This is reprimanded in Islam. And matter of fact, in some cases, this can lead to becoming a haram act, a prohibited act, and it could be considered a sin. Pessimism, negativity, always thinking that the glass is half empty, these are un-Islamic ideas. Islam teaches us to be positive. Imam Ali alayhi salam and his universal persona teaches us to be positive. There are so many beautiful things in our lives. And sometimes we say, well, we are facing a trial or a difficulty. If we look at it in a positive manner, yes, it might be difficult, but it will help us to get through that difficulty if we look at it as a positive thing that is happening. In the traditions, we find that the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam, they say that when Allah wants somebody to come close to him after they have sinned, Allah puts them through some kind of a small punishment, a small difficulty, a small test, so that that individual turns towards the Almighty Allah and asks for forgiveness. So even that small problem that we're facing, that difficulty that we're facing, that issue that has come up, this thing that is worrying us could very well be a path and a door to turn towards the Almighty Allah and ask for forgiveness. But again, we have to have a positive outlook. It is that positive outlook that will give us the peace and mind to turn towards Allah in a positive aspect so that we can open our hands and beg at the door of the Almighty Allah, the one who is constantly waiting for us to return to Him, to turn to Him, to ask from Him, to beseech from Him, to supplicate to Him. These are just a few of the things that we learn from Imam Ali alayhi salam. Always, dear brothers and sisters, have a positive outlook on your life, and most especially when you are going through those difficult times. A very heart-moving lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRab English Radio, the program To My Brother. This moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. أشهد أنك جاهدت في الله حق جهاده وعملت بكتابه واتبعت سنن نبيه.
I testify that you made utmost efforts, as it should be, in the cause of Allah, acted upon His book, followed the way of life of His Prophet, blessings of Allah be on him and his children, to the last moment of your life, until Allah invited you to come unto Him and used His discretion to take you away and sealed your enemy's doom with the blame that the arguments had been made known to one and all through you. O Allah, let me be happy and satisfied with that which Thou considers good for me. Let me agree with that which Thou decides for me. Let me passionately remember Thee and invoke Thee. Let me be in love with Thy pure and sincere friends. Let me be well-liked and respected on the earth and in the heavens. Let me be unruffled and well-composed in the midst of misfortunes. Let me be gratefully thankful in prosperity. Let me be mindful of much and more bounties. Let me ardently desire for the heart-warming meeting with Thee, well-equipped with piety to gain my end on the day of requital. Let me follow into the footsteps of Thy representatives. Let me disassociate myself from the mannerism of Thy enemies. Let me pass my time in this world by praising and glorifying Thee.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Surah Tawbah is one of the last surahs to be revealed. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, يُرِيدُونَ أَنْ يُطْفَعَ نُورَ اللَّهَ بِأَفْوَاهِهِمْ. That there are people who wish to put all out the light of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. They would like to blow off the nur of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.